From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Our next guest is renowned Cambridge zoologist Eric Kirschenbaum, who has written The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. If you've ever wondered what life on other planets would be like, well, this book will help us understand what these aliens may look like, how they will move, socialize, and communicate. Lynn and I pre-taped this interview last week, and here now is that conversation for you. Eric Kirschenbaum, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Well, we're delighted to have you. We really enjoyed the book very much. You write in the book that the rules of physics and biology may apply all over the universe, and aliens are not going to break those laws. What did you mean by that?
Well, we're all very comfortable with thinking that the laws of physics apply throughout the universe, right? If you drop a rock on Earth, it'll fall. If you drop a rock on another planet, it'll fall. Gravity just works that way. It's much less familiar to think about laws of biology that might be universal, but they're there. They are there. It took us a little bit longer to understand what they are than to understand the laws of physics. But essentially, the idea that all life evolves through natural selection and what are the constraints on natural selection, how it works, what might cause animals to evolve one way or another way. These are things that we're starting to understand fairly well now.
Yeah. And there's a lot of attention to perseverance and the planet Mars with the latest landing by Perseverance. And one of the things I wanted to ask you is it's a little colder in Mars. And because of that, the speed of sound is down to 540 miles an hour versus 760. So it's going to take a little longer for sound to get to you. And because the Martian atmosphere is 100 times less dense than on Earth, you have to speak a little louder if you're standing next to someone, probably a lot louder. And also the sound quality, I read that 96% carbon dioxide would absorb a lot of higher pitched sounds. So although aliens would have to work with the same sort of laws of physics that we do on our planet, on the planet Mars, would that mean that maybe aliens would have larger ears or would have ways of being able to vocalize differently or louder, that sort of thing?
Certainly, we can look at the environment on a planet and say what kind of communication would work well, what kind of communication would be more difficult. And it's certainly true that on Mars, sound is a problem. But don't forget that Mars used to have a very different environment. And we don't think there's life on Mars now, but if there ever were, it was at a time when the atmosphere was much thicker. And so sound might have been more appropriate than it could well have be that animals or organisms evolved to use sound back then. And then as the atmosphere thinned and they died, presumably, and went extinct. But if they didn't, they'd still be stuck with the vestiges of their evolutionary past, which had them communicating by sound, in which case, you know, they would have to adapt and as you say, be louder or lower frequency or something like that.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, our guest is Eric Kirschenbaum. His new book is The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. It's quite egocentric, I guess is the word, to think even that our forms of communication as humans here are superior to the communications of dolphins or wolves, or even as you talk about your canine companion, as I have one sitting right next to me, who you said winks at you, which I love. And, you know, as we know, many of our dogs smile. So tell us, start with the study of wolves in Yellowstone, because that's pretty adjacent to where we are here and interesting how that relates to the story.
So when we look at animal communication, which I do, that's my day job, the real question we're asking is what are they saying, How much information is there? What are they saying to each other? And why? Why do they need to say these things? And with wolves, we got a pretty good idea of what they're saying. They're saying, this is our territory. They're saying, come home for dinner. And they're also sometimes just howling because they enjoy it. Which is something which shouldn't be dismissed as unscientific. We know that animals that live in social groups often behave with communal behaviors that serve to strengthen the social bonds in that group. So that is an important part of communication, of any kind of social animal communication. What's particularly interesting about wolves in the context of alien communication is that It's a signal that's evolved specifically for long-range communication. So for calling across many for miles in effect, and it's difficult to communicate over such long distances. Not every signal will do it. Not every signal can be heard miles away. So the howl has evolved to fit the constraints of long-range communication in the atmosphere of this planet. There are not that many ways you can do it. In fact, it happens that most of the sound gets absorbed very quickly over long distances. And the way that wolves deal with that problem by changing the pitch of their howl up and down and up and down, just about the only way that you can transmit that information over those distances. So when I say that alien wolves will howl, it's not a frivolous statement. It's simply that under those circumstances, there aren't that many other ways of doing it.
Yes, that's interesting. And so I imagine that, you know, as you say, that we have to stop thinking about life on other planets of, you know, the monsters that have been in, you know, the movies that we've all seen growing up, the science fiction. It's not science fiction. It is, you know, it's something that we ought to take as, again, more a less egocentric view, and more just accepting the way that the relationships that there are both with humans and animals on Earth, and just apply that same sort of thinking about intelligence to, you know, to space. So I'm thinking, you know, the word alien is such a strange one, and I'm sure that you've come up with much better words. What would be your words?
I don't have a problem with the word, because, you know, the thing about alien life is that it won't be related to us, and this is kind of a problem, because we tend to think, certainly for the last 150 years since Darwin came up with the theory of evolution, we define how similar we are to other animals by how closely related we are to them. You know, everyone feels some sort of similarity with a chimpanzee. You go see a chimpanzee in the zoo, looks kind of human, and they act kind of human. That's because they're closely related to us. Aliens won't be related to us at all. So does that mean then that we have no identity with them? We have no similarity with them? That can't be right. Because if we were to come across an alien species that looked like us and talked like us and had spaceships like us, it would be unreasonable to say that they're not like us because they're not related. So there is an issue here with what is similarity? What is human about humans? Is it just our genetics? Is it just our family history? Probably not. Probably that's not sufficient.
And we spoke earlier about sound, Eric, and you point out in the book, and this is fascinating, that birds, bats, insects, they all evolved wings completely separately. And you realize that there just aren't that many ways to travel through the air. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so it's easy to observe that there are different kinds of wings on Earth, and bat wings and bird wings are quite different, but they're still wings. So the question is, is this something Earth-like? Are they similar because they both evolved on Earth? They both had a common ancestor many hundreds of millions of years ago. Or is there something fundamental, something essential about wings that would make them exist on other planets as well? And that comes back to the laws of physics. There aren't that many different ways to fly. There really aren't. And the only ways we know of that you can fly have all been exploited by animals on Earth. There are animals that jump. There are animals that float. There aren't animals that float through the air, but there are animals that float through the sea. And that's okay. That's the same. That's still flying because water and gas are both kinds of fluids. But then there are the ones who use wings, both in the air and also fins in the sea. And it's the same aerodynamic or hydrodynamic principles that are not Earth specific. These are principles that will guide flight on other planets as well.
You know, Eric, my mother used to tell me that everything's time and place. And a lot of people ask, where are those aliens anyway? And it could be time and place. When you look at the arrow of time, and if we're 13.7 billion years old, the universe, Neil deGrasse Tyson said recently that if you look at a football field and the blade of grass on the one side of the football field is the Big Bang, and you go all the way across the football field into the end zone, into the back of the end zone, the last blade of grass will be when humans showed up on Earth. So time and place is pretty important, isn't it?
It is, and we are very far away from any other star. So we don't know of any technology that we could think of, or even that an alien civilization could think of, that would make it reasonable to travel, physically travel between stars. Not to say it's impossible, but we don't know any way that it could happen. So it could be that alien species are simply too far away ever to observe. But as you say, it's also possible that we might just miss our neighbors in time. We've only been looking for 100 years or so, but they may be long extinct. They may not have evolved yet. So there are a lot of questions there. It's worth noting, however, just on that point, which has been a popular point, it's worth noting that the Earth is a relatively young planet. There are a lot of planets around that are much older than the Earth. And so it's not like we are likely to be the first. It's more likely that we are a later generation of life in the galaxy.
Your connections of the work you do as a zoologist to what might be out there in the galaxy remind me that unless we learn about what's going on in our own planet and study animal behavior and animal communication, then certainly how can we ever begin to imagine life on other planets? And this is the value of your book. And also it really illuminates some of these points, these things that we don't realize. You talk about using electricity for communication, for example, among fish, for example. There's an electrical, you know, impulse that would indicate social status, for example. Talk about that and how something like that makes you imagine with a more clear picture what might be out there.
Well, we're so used to speaking and understanding through speech that we almost think that it's the only way to communicate. And of course, we know that animals use vision quite a lot. You know, birds have colors and things like that. So we can perceive that. When it comes to other forms of communication, though, it's extremely difficult for us to enter into the minds of these animals. And when you think about electric fishes, for instance, that have this incredible way of just of sensing the environment around them, they generate an electric field around them, and then they pick up tiny variations in this field caused by other objects that they're passing. Their perception of the world is utterly incomprehensible to us. But then they use this for communication as well. What would it be like to communicate using electric fields, electric pulses? It's almost impossible for us to imagine. But again, coming back to the question of flight, there aren't that many different ways that you can send signals, send information from one place to another. And by the time you've gone through, you know, sound, sight, smell, and electricity, you've pretty much used them all up. So studying the different ways that animals communicate on Earth, we've we've almost covered just about all the ways that aliens could do it as well.
If you are just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Eric Kirschenbaum. He's a zoologist, he's a college lecturer, and he's a fellow at the Girton College, University of Cambridge in England. He's written the book, The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. What's the biggest mistake that science fiction, that our culture makes in portraying these aliens?
I'm very soft on science fiction. Right? I don't hold them to account very much on their alien depictions, because I think that whereas the budgets might not stretch very much to makeup and to fancy costumes, I think that they're really there to portray the behavior of these alien species. And a lot of the behaviors that they're portraying are behaviors that we see on Earth, you know, territoriality and aggression and also more positive emotions as well. I think those will be present on other planets too. The big thing I think that science fiction sometimes gets wrong, and I think that people get this wrong about life on Earth as well, is to think that just because a particular trait or a particular characteristic is useful, is good for an animal, that means that it could evolve. And that's not really the case, that there are some things that would be fantastic if you had them, but there's no way for them actually to evolve step by step. And the best example are things like telepathy. Wouldn't it be great if we were all telepathic? Well, of course it would, but it's not at all clear how telepathy could evolve, because there's no point in broadcasting your thoughts if no one's listening. So there's no sort of starting point for that evolutionary process. So I think most superpowers that are observed in science fiction are somewhat questionable.
Yeah, because they all seem to have a lot of superpowers, and if they're going to be following the same laws of physics as we have in our development and all the other creatures on Earth, there probably won't be these crazy superpowers that we see when they come in and blow up half the Earth and all the different things that they do. So yeah, it's interesting. What surprised you with all the research that you have done? Was there anything that grabbed your attention for this book?
Well, going back a number of years, one of the things that kind of started me thinking along this line of common processes and common principles is when I started working with wolves. I had actually previously been working with dolphins. And when you compare, when you listen to a dolphin whistle and a wolf howl, they don't sound anything the same. But when you look at them using the kinds of visualization tools that we use when we study animal communication, they appear very, very similar. And in fact, if you take a dolphin whistle and you slow it down about 30 times, it sounds like a wolf howl.
Really?
Now, the reason for that is actually quite clear. Dolphins are doing the same thing that wolves need to do. They're communicating over long distances in a very disruptive environment. The sound is absorbed very, very strongly underwater. And so they are using that same technique of varying their pitch up and down to contain information that they want to convey. So that was a really interesting illustration here on Earth of how certain problems don't have that many different solutions, that actually it's not infinitely variable. If this problem arose on another planet, there also wouldn't be that many different ways to solve it.
I just wanted to ask you, Eric, before we let you go, I think it's interesting that we had to have a physicist come up with the paradox, Fermi's paradox or Fermi's paradox, that sort of points out that it's just kind of common sense that there's probably alien life. And even though I read the Fermi paradox over, I think, well, yeah, isn't he just kind of stating common sense? I don't know. What do you have to say about that?
I think it was an interesting observation at the time, because of course at the time no one had any idea of the likelihood of alien life. It was completely intellectual exercise with no connection to the observed world. And how we've come on in those 60 or 70 years since then, that now we do understand a lot of this. Now we do know that there are planets around other stars, and there are billions of planets around other stars. And so the whole question has become a very practical question. It's not just an intellectual exercise anymore. It's something that we need to go out there and measure and get the answer to.
Eric Kirschenbaum has written The Zoologist's Guide to the Galaxy, What Animals on Earth Reveal About Aliens and Ourselves. We want to thank you for joining us this morning on Cool Science Radio, and we wish you continued success with your book.
Thank you very much. It's been great fun. Great.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.